precipitous peaks, less dangerous valleys. Thurman spoke of sacrifice, of the greater good, of individual lives proving meaningless in the far stretch of time. He took that shadow's rage and redirected it until the torture of being locked up for months with the books of the legacy was distilled down to its very essence. And through it all, it didn't sound as though the silo head breathed once. "Tell me what needs to be fixed," Thurman said, after their discussion. He laid the problem at the shadow's feet. Donald saw how this was better than simply handing him the solution. The shadow spoke of a culture forming that overvalued individuality, of children that wanted to get away from their families, of generations living levels apart, and independence stressed until no one relied on anyone, and everyone was dispensable. The sobs came. Donald watched as Thurman's face tightened, and he wondered again if he was about to see the young man put out of his misery. Instead, Thurman released the radio and said to those gathered around simply, "He's ready." And what started as an inquiry, a test of Donald's theory, concluded this boy's rite of initiation. A shadow became a man. Lines on a screen settled into steel cords of resolve as his anger was given a new focus, a new purpose. His childhood was seen differently, dangerously. Thurman gave this young man his first order. Mr. Wick congratulated the boy and told him he would be allowed to go, would be given his freedom. And later, as Donald and Thurman rode the lift back toward Anna, Thurman declared that in the years to come, this Rodney would make a fine silo head, even better than the last. Chapter 51. That afternoon, Donald and Anna worked to restore order to the war room. They made it ready in case it was called upon in a future shift. All their notes were taken off the walls and filed away into airtight plastic crates, and Donald imagined these would sit on another level somewhere, in another storeroom, to gather dust. The computers were unplugged, all the wiring coiled up, and these were hauled off by Erskine on a cart with squeaky wheels. All that was left were the cots, a change of clothes, and the standard-issue toiletries, enough to get them through the night and to their meeting with Dr. Sneed the following day. Several shifts were about to come to a close. For Anna and Thurman, it had been a long time coming. Two full shifts, almost a year awake. Erskine and Sneed would need a few weeks to finish their work, and by that time the next head would come on, and the schedule would return to normal. For Donald, it had been less than a week awake after a century of sleep. He was a dead man who had blinked his eyes open for but a brief moment. He took his last shower and his first dose of the bitter drink so that no one would think anything was amiss. But Donald didn't plan on going under again. If he went back to the deep freeze, he knew they would never wake him again. Unless things were so bad that he wouldn't want to be woken anyway. Unless it were Anna once more, lonely, wishing for company and willing to subject him to abuse in order to get it. That wasn't sleep. That was a body and a mind stored away. There were other choices, more final escapes. Donald had discovered this resolve by following the trail of clues left behind by Victor, and he would soon join him in death. He walked a final lap amid the guns and drones before finally retiring to his cot. He thought of Helen as he lay there listening to Anna sing in the shower one last time. And he realized the anger he had felt for his wife, having lived and loved without him, had now dissipated, wiped away by his guilt for coming to find solace in Anna's embrace. And when she came to him that night, straight from the shower with water beading on her flesh, he could not resist any longer. They had the same bitter drink on their breath, that concoction that prepped their veins for the deep sleep, and neither of them cared. Donald succumbed. And then he waited until she had returned to her cot and her breathing had softened, before he cried himself to sleep. When he woke, Anna was already gone, her cot neatly made. Donald did the same, tucking the sheet beneath the mattress and leaving the corners crisp, even though he knew the sheets would be mussed as the cots were returned to their rightful place in the barracks. He checked the time. Anna had been put under during the early morning, so as not to be spotted. He had less than an hour before Thurman would come for him. More than enough time. He went out of the storeroom and approached the drone nearest the hangar door. Yanking the tarp off sent a cloud of dust into the air. He dragged out the empty plastic crate from under one of the wings, opened the low hangar door, and arranged the bin so that it was slightly inside the lift. He lowered the door onto the crate to keep the hangar open. Hurrying down the hallway, past the empty barracks, he pulled the plastic sheet off the station at the very end. Flipping the plastic cover off the lift switch, he threw it into the up position. The first time he'd done this, the door to the lift would no longer open, but he could hear the platform rumbling upward on the other side of the wall. It hadn't taken long to figure out a solution. Replacing the plastic sheet, he hurried down the hall, turned the light off, and shut the door. He pulled the other bin from under the drone's left wing. Donald stripped and tossed his clothes under the drone. He pulled the thick plastic suit from the bin and sat down to work his feet into the legs. The boots went on next, Donald being careful to seal the cuffs around them. Standing up, he gripped the dangling shoelace stolen from an extra boot. The end had been tied to the zipper on the back of the suit. He pulled it over his shoulder and tugged upward, made sure the zipper went to the top before grabbing the gloves, flashlight, and helmet from the bin. Suited up, he closed the bin and slid it back under the wing, covered the drone with the tarp. There would only be a single bin out of place when Thurman arrived. Victor had left a mess to discover. Donald would hardly leave a trace. He crawled inside the lift, pushing the flashlight ahead of him. He could hear the motor straining against the pinned crate like an angry hive of bees. Turning on the flashlight, he took a last look at the storeroom, braced himself, then kicked the plastic tub with both boots. It budged. He kicked again, and there was a thunderous racket as the door slammed shut, and then the shudder of movement. The flashlight jittered and danced. Donald corralled it between his mitts, and watched his exhalations fog the inside of his helmet. He had no idea what to expect, but he was causing it. He would control his own fate. Chapter 52. The ride up took much longer than he anticipated. There were moments when he wasn't sure whether or not he was moving. He grew worried that his plan had been discovered, that the misplaced bin had led them to his tracks in the dust, and he was being recalled. He urged the lift to hurry along. His flashlight gave out. Donald tapped the cylinder in his mitt and worked the switch back and forth. It must have been on a weak charge from its long storage. He was left in the dark, no way of knowing which way was up or down, whether he was rising or falling. All he could do was wait. He knew that this was the right decision. There was nothing worse than being trapped in the darkness, in that pod, unable to do anything more than wait. Arrival came with a jarring clank. The persistent hum of the motor disappeared, the ensuing quiet haunting. There was a second clank, and then the door opposite the one he'd entered rose slowly. A metal attachment the size of a fist slid forward on a track. Donald scrambled after this, seeing how the drone might be guided forward. He found himself in a sloping launch bay. He hadn't known what to expect, thought maybe he'd simply arrive above the soil on a barren landscape, but he was in a shaft. Above him, up the slope, a slit was opening, a dim light growing stronger. Beyond this slit, Donald spotted the roiling clouds he knew from the cafeteria. They were the bright grey that came with the sunrise. The doors at the top of the slope continued to slide apart like a maw opening wide. Donald crawled up the steep slope as quickly as he could. The metal car in the track stopped and locked into place. Donald hurried, imagining he didn't have much time. He stayed off the track in case the launch sequence was automated, but the car never moved, never raced by. He arrived at the open doors exhausted and perspiring, and pulled himself out. The world spread out before him. After a week of living in a windowless chamber, the scale and openness were inspiring. Donald felt like tearing off his helmet and sucking in deep breaths. The oppressive weight of his silo imprisonment had been lifted. Above him were only clouds. He stood on a round concrete platform. Behind the opening for the launch ramp was a cluster of antennae. He went to these, held on to one of them, and lowered himself to the wide ledge below. From here it was a scramble on his belly, trying to hold on to the slick edge with bulky gloves, and then a graceless drop to the dirt. He scanned the horizon for the city, had to work his way around the tower to find it. From there, he aimed 45 degrees to the left. He had studied the maps to make sure, but now that he was there, he realized he could have done it by memory. Over there was where the tents had stood, and here the stage, and beyond them the dirt tracks through the struggling beginnings of grass as ATVs buzzed up the hillside. He could almost smell the food that had been cooking, could hear the dogs barking and children playing, the anthems in the air. Donald shook off thoughts of the past and made his time count. He knew there was a chance, a very good chance, that someone was sitting at breakfast in the cafeteria. At this very moment, they would be dropping their spoons and pointing at the wall screen. But he had a head start. They would have to wrestle with suits and wonder if the risk was worth it. By the time they got to him, it would be too late. Hopefully, they would simply leave him be. He worked his way up the hillside. Movement was a struggle inside the bulky suit. He slipped and fell several times in the slick soil. When a gust of wind hammered the landscape, it peppered his helmet with grit and made a noise like the hiss of Anna's radio. There was no telling how long the suit would last. He knew enough of the cleaning to suspect it wouldn't be forever, but Anna had told him that the machines in the air were designed to attack only certain things. That's why they didn't destroy the sensors, or the concrete, or a properly built suit. And he suspected the suits in Silo 1 would have been built properly. All he hoped for, as he labored up the hill, was a view. He was so obsessed and determined to win this, that he never thought to look behind him, slipping and scrambling, crawling on his hands and knees the last 50 feet, until he was finally at the summit. He stood and staggered forward, exhausted, breathing heavily. Reaching the edge, he peered down into the adjacent bowl. There, a concrete tower stood like a gravestone, like a monument to Helen. She was buried beneath that tower. And while he could never go to her, never be buried alongside her, he could lie down underneath the clouds and be close enough. He wanted his helmet off. First, though, his gloves. He tugged one of them free, popping the seal, and dropped it to the soil. The heavy wind sent the glove tumbling down the slope, and the swirling grit stung his hand. The peppering of fine particles burned like a day on a windy beach. Donald began tugging on his other glove, resigned to what would come next, when suddenly he felt a hand grip his shoulder, and he was pulled back from the edge of that gentle rise and the view of his wife's last resting place. Chapter 53. Donald stumbled and fell. The shock of being touched sent his heart into his throat. He waved his arms to free himself, but someone had a grip on his suit, more than one person. They dragged him back until he could no longer see beyond the ridge. Screams of frustration filled his helmet. Couldn't they see that it was too late? Couldn't they leave him be? He flailed and tried to lunge out of their grip, but he was being pulled inexorably down the hill, back toward Silo 1. And when he fell the next time, he was able to roll over and face them, to get his arms up to defend himself. And there was Thurman, standing over him, wearing nothing more than his white coveralls, dust from the dead earth gathering in the old man's grey brow. "It's time to go," Thurman yelled into the heavy wind. His voice seemed as distant as the clouds.